About issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Clayton Doffenbaugh from the Sierra Club about public lands at risk. Clayton, we're talking with you by phone in Chicago. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, indeed.
Why are public lands at risk?
Public lands are at risk because people want to exploit them for profit, and also as a result of government policies facilitating that exploitation.
So that's always been a temptation. How has it been avoided in the past?
Americans, particularly in the last century, have been very supportive of the conservation of public lands. Yellowstone National Park was the first national park in the world, and it's one of the gifts of our nation to the world, and many have followed. And other means of conserving land in wilderness areas and wildlife refuges and what have you have been developed here in the United States.
But those public lands have always been valuable for other reasons, as you say, for commerce. They have timber on them. They have minerals under them often. Why did Americans in the past feel it was more important to not exploit that part of them?
Well, Americans have for a long time felt that it's important to save a portion of the public lands so that they continue to exist more or less in the way that God has created them and the way that they've developed over the years and over the centuries. It's important for just the intrinsic value of the land itself. It's important for people to be able to go and experience the beauty and the spiritual values of those lands. And also, it's important for many folks, including myself, for religious reasons, simply to be good stewards of the creation that God has given us.
This is a program that deals with ethics and values as well as religion and spirituality. But you've mentioned both religion and spirituality in talking about these public lands. How is that appropriate in a country that's basically secular?
Well, it's appropriate from the standpoint of individual citizens and what would motivate us to want to preserve the lands. Citizens have a right in a democracy for whatever reasons motivate them to speak about public policy.
Now, the Sierra Club is an organization that is a big tent. It has many people in it who are concerned for many different motives with preserving the natural environment, the natural world. How do you represent the Sierra Club?
Well, I'm an employee of the Sierra Club, a national conservation organizer. So that's one way I represent the Sierra Club. And as you said, it is a big tent, 750,000 members across the country, the oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization in America. And so there are many people with a variety of motivations for why they would want to conserve the land who participate in the Sierra Club.
And
faith is one of those motivations.
Mm-hmm. And what is the crisis that's facing public lands now?
Well, there's, as you've alluded to, there's been an ongoing problem with over-exploitation of land, and in particular the public lands. But we have two things that are happening right now that have been increased in recent years. One is the desire for increased economic exploitation, particularly for energy sources, but also for timber. And another has to do with the undermining of the democratic principles that undergird the policy-making decisions on the public lands. It's important to remember that the public lands are not owned by the government. The government simply manages them. The public lands are owned by all the citizens of the United States. And the procedures that have been put in place over the last century have increasingly allowed for citizen input and participation in the management decisions for particular units of the public lands all over the country. And in recent years, regulations have been changed that are reducing the ability of people to be informed and participate in those decisions. So we have a crisis of exploitation and a crisis of attacks on democracy and public land management.
Can you give us some examples of how these regulations have changed, which have put public lands much more at risk now than before?
Decisions made for governing the public lands are generally guided by a law called the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA for short. Recent regulatory changes here just in the last few months in the National Forest Service, which manages all the national forests across the country, allow for Forest Service managers to exclude their plans for the public lands from the National Environmental Policy Act. And that means that it's possible, though not mandatory, but possible, for Forest Service managers to exclude scientific research that pertains to what's best, the best use for the lands, and public notice and public participation in the plans. And so that is a major threat, and that's probably the biggest example that's come down the pike in recent months.
Now, when you talk about these changes that have happened in the way the National Forest Service has to report its plans and so on, how does the Sierra Club even know about this?
Well, they have to publish any changes in the regulations in the Federal Register.
Ah, okay.
I don't know too many people who read the Federal Register, over dinner in the evening. But there are a few people out there who have to do it professionally, and we rely on them to alert the rest of us.
So the Sierra Club, part of its function is to be a watchdog.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How is the Sierra Club organized to carry out its concerns?
The Sierra Club is it's a national organization, so it's organized at the national level. It has chapters across the country, 64 of them. One of them is in Illinois. Most of the chapters correspond to states, but some don't. And then the states themselves, the chapters, are broken down into what are called groups. And at each level, it is volunteers who control the policy-making, decision-making apparatus of the Sierra Club. And those people at each level are elected by other Sierra Club members.
How long have you been on the staff of the Sierra Club?
For about a year. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was active as a volunteer for 10 years.
How did you get involved?
I got involved as a result of family vacations to the southwest of our country and camping and hiking out there with my wife and then with my kids as they came along. And through that, I went on an outing, a Sierra Club outing, to the state of Utah, and from that I became a volunteer participant in the Sierra Club's National Utah Wilderness Task Force, and I guess the rest is history. So.
What did you do on that task force?
Reviewed various issues, particularly at the national level, pertaining to a proposal for the preservation of 9 million acres of public lands, Bureau of Land Management lands in the state of Utah. We educate the public regarding that and sought support from our elected representatives for it as well.
So the Sierra Club is a watchdog agency. It's a agency that tries to educate and lobby, I take it.
Yes.
What else does it do?
Well, it also has outings. We try to enjoy as well as protect the natural world. Huge portion of the Sierra Club activities has to do with enabling folks to get out on the land and experience it and enjoy it.
How are those outings organized?
If you're a member of the Sierra Club, every January in the national magazine, Sierra Magazine, there's a listing of all the outings. And if you're interested in one, you contact the outings leader. And if you want to go, you pay a fee. and then you're guided through the area that you're going to. There are a variety of different outings. There's backpacking trips. There's more like car camping trips. Some outings are in cabins and so forth, but the majority of them involve camping out in nature, and many of them hiking many miles back into the wilderness.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Clayton Doffenbaugh from the Sierra Club. He's with us by phone from Chicago. Let me encourage other listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question or a comment about the Sierra Club or about the issue we're talking about today, public lands at risk, do call us. This is a live program. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the internet in the continental U.S., you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of our station. In Champaign-Urbana, you can reach several local lines by punching in 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL will get you on the air with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Clayton, you're going to be speaking in Champaign-Urbana several places, I know, this coming week.
Yeah.
Could you tell us when and where?
Well, there's five of them. the first one is this coming Tuesday night at 7:30. At Wesley United Methodist Church, 1203 West Green Street.
That's the corner of Green and, what street is that? I should know.
I'm not 100% sure myself. But,
it'll come.
Near the intersection with Lincoln, I believe. And then Wednesday night, March 16th at 7:30, the local Sierra Club group, the Prairie Group of the Sierra Club, is meeting at I hope I pronounced this right, Civitas, at 112 West Main in Urbana.
Okay.
Thursday at noon at the Kiwanis Club meeting at the Chancellor Hotel. Thursday at 4 p.m. at the University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street.
I did know that corner, Chalmers and Wright.
yes. And also Thursday night at 7 o'clock at First United Methodist in Champaign, which I believe is at the corner of Church and State.
There you go. Campaign. So you're going to be very busy. Now, what are your topics similar in all those locations?
Yes, the topic is similar. The presentations at the churches will emphasize the spiritual and scriptural foundations for care of creation.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit on this show. Many people feel that one of the problems with the lack of concern for the environment has come up in Western countries influenced by Christianity that somehow interpret Genesis and the Bible as giving human beings a higher point on the evolutionary scale than everything else, and therefore that humans somehow have the right to exploit nature. Do you think that's a misreading of the ancient biblical text?
Oh, I do indeed. The psalmist was very clear that the earth and all of creation, including us, belong to God. Genesis is quite clear that the human role in creation is both to cultivate and to take care of it. We are called to do both of those things. And just simply exploiting it for our own ends would be a failure. A sin, I suppose, because it would be a failure to heed the call to take care of creation.
Now, so listeners may know where you're coming from. What's your personal religious background?
I'm a lifelong United Methodist, grown up in a church family, and that's it. I'm Christian. So,
and how do you? How do you come to your interpretation of the Bible? Who's influenced you? Who have you read?
Well, I've read the book myself and studied it and reviewed it from this particular perspective. Just from my own experience, out hiking and camping and being out in nature, I would say those are the two biggest influences.
Now, some people can wax quite poetic about nature and have, and that's certainly appropriate. There's much beauty in nature, but there's also a lot of horror, isn't there? It's you know, blood and tooth and claw and all of that. How do you reconcile the violence in nature with religious perspective you come from?
Well, first of all, I don't pretend to have the answer to everything. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But otherwise, I think when you look at nature, one of the things that you see is that it's a great cycle. All things are very dependent upon each other. Nothing survives on its own. And that cycle even includes death. When things die, it's like a seed. Other life comes from that death. And I also am of the belief, I guess what one would call an afterlife, in that our death here on Earth is not the end of things. So I don't know if that reconciles it. It certainly does not eliminate the pain that comes from things like the tsunami or just the death that all of us ultimately will experience. But I think it does show that there is a continuity and that the whole is greater than the parts, and that includes us as well.
How do you respond to the kind of criticism that people who are concerned for the environment often get from the far right, being called, you know, tree huggers and people who just aren't really aware of the practical things in life that we need to cut down trees to have houses, we need to have oil and minerals to fuel the things we want to do in this world? How do you respond to those kind of comments?
Well, certainly we need those things, but we don't have to take them from everywhere. That we need to be humble enough to leave some places as they were created. The public lands are a good example. They're governed under our laws for multiple use, and that means some parts of them are used for some things and some parts for other things. So we don't have to use all of the land in order to get timber or in order to get oil and gas. And, of course, there's many lands that are private lands, and those lands are used for those things as well. Just to take the example of oil, if we were to take all of the oil from our public lands that's available there, it's in the big scale of things, it's a drop in the bucket. It is not going to have a major long-term impact on our energy supplies. So there is not a need or a necessity to use all of that oil, and we can use those lands for other reasons. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is very much in the news now, is, I suppose, Exhibit A. It's one of the most pristine wildernesses left in creation. And the oil that would come out of there, if we were able, which we wouldn't be, to take it all out at once, it would provide us 6 months' supply. And it seems hardly worth it to destroy such a beautiful place, one of the few that remains untouched, for 6 months' worth of oil. It seems to me to be a waste.
Where are some of the other locations where public land is currently at risk?
Well, to focus on energy development, many of the grasslands in eastern Wyoming and eastern Montana are under threat for oil and gas development. Coal bed methane is a very popular exploitation of those lands. Now, there was a recent proposal approved by the Bureau of Land Management to allow for leasing that could provide for as many as 80,000 new wells in that area. And that involves not just bringing the resource out, but also there's a lot of water that is used in a fairly arid area, and the water becomes polluted, so it becomes unsuitable for wildlife or for cattle that graze the land. Many of the ranchers in that part of the country are very upset with what's going on. Oil developments have been sought in the state of Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. In the state of Utah in particular, there are places that have been set aside administratively for conservation purposes that have had those rulings rescinded, and they're now being opened for leasing for oil development. So these are places that were recognized as being still relatively unspoiled, and beautiful places and special places for wildlife that no longer are being protected and are now scheduled for being exploited.
1-800-222-9455 will enable long-distance callers to call this station toll-free to participate in this live call-in program, Keeping the Faith. In Champaign-Urbana, where the WLL studios are, you may reach this program by punching in a local number, 333-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Our guest today is Clayton Doffenbaugh. We're talking to him from Chicago by phone, representing the Sierra Club. Clayton, when you talk about the grasslands that are at risk in the far west and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, these places seem so far away often from us here in the Midwest. Are there public lands at risk closer by?
Certainly. There's the further east you go, there's less and less public lands. But the Shawnee National Forest in the southern part of Illinois, just 2 days ago, the draft management plan for that forest was released. And I don't know all the particulars of what's in it, but I know that some of the things that Sierra Club has been hoping for was to find some additional designations of wilderness areas down in the Shawnee Forest, comparatively small in relation to what's out west, but still nevertheless wild areas down in the Shawnee. There's been significant damage in the forest from off-road vehicles and dirt bikes and that sort of thing, and we're hoping for provisions to protect the forest in the southern tip of Illinois from those things as well.
We have a caller waiting on line four, our toll-free line. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'd like to thank your guest for his work. I think this is vital to integrate Christian faith and environmental ethic. The question I have is, we seem to have been in a very predominant conservative political mood in this country for many years, but I'm fascinated why people who call themselves conservatives, and especially who try to self-describe them as people of faith, are so resistant to the idea of the reduction of consumption of natural resources, especially since we use such a large proportion in the world, and much more specifically in light of you were just talking about the Arctic National Forest, and I believe your guest said it would only be 6 months' worth of fuel. Why our political leaders are so resistant to the idea of declaring war on energy waste, because we are probably the biggest energy waste in the world, and I think a very significant amount of environmental good could be done by declaring war on the SUVs and monumental movements toward mass transit and other things, and it would save money, and it would do a great amount of good. Could your guest comment, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Boy, there's a lot there. The conservation is certainly a key. If we were to increase the mileage requirements for automobiles, that effort alone would save us more oil than we would gain from drilling the Arctic Refuge. And it would save it over and over again, year in and year out. Investment in renewable energy is another thing. There's a wind farm. If you go up I-39 on the way to Rockford near the intersection with the toll road there, there's about four dozen windmills out there. This is a clean, renewable source of energy, and it's a secure source of energy. Oil is not, because we're so dependent on overseas supplies, oil is not a secure source of energy for our country. We need to develop clean, secure, and renewable sources of energy if we're going to maintain our way of life in the coming decades and centuries. And we need to reduce the amount of use that we have for sources of energy that ultimately will run out, such as oil.
What about the need for mass transit?
Mass transit is an excellent means for conserving on energy use. The ratio of passenger miles per amount of energy use is much better in mass transit, and so we should provide for it. In fact, in places with large populations, it can ultimately be much cheaper and easier for people to get around that way than it can be in a car. Just walking to the corner store as opposed to driving there is also good for our health, and it's good for the environment's health as well.
There apparently is nothing in the next fiscal year's budget nationally to support passenger train travel in the U.S.
Yes, the president's proposed budget has zeroed out the budget for Amtrak. I believe based on the idea that interstate rail traffic should be a profitable enterprise, which would make it kind of unique among our transportation modes here in the country, because certainly highways and aircraft and what have you are all subsidized. I'm not quite sure why Amtrak should be different, but apparently that's the feeling.
And folks who have traveled on the train systems in Europe or Asia with the high-speed, very efficient electric trains know how popular they've been and how successful economically.
Yes, well, Amtrak's routes, certainly in the Northeast Corridor of the country, have been very popular. I've traveled on those and found them very nice, as well as traveling on the train out west. You can see some beautiful places that way as well.
And not even to mention France.
There you go.
We're about at our halfway time talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh from the Sierra Club about public lands at risk. Let me give him just a moment to take a sip of water and refresh himself while I let listeners know what's coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Next week we'll be talking with Professor Bruce Falk from the University of Illinois about evolution and religion. That'll be March 20 here on Keeping the Faith. On March 27, which is the Sunday of the Christian celebration of Easter this year, we'll be talking with Martin Marty, internationally known religious scholar from the University of Chicago, and with Richard Young, the violist for the Vermeer String Quartet. We'll be talking about Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ, a wonderful string quartet piece that the Vermeer plays around the world. And we're going to be talking about Richard Young's new book of meditations that Martin Marty is one of the writers for. That's on Easter Sunday, March 27th. On April 3rd, we'll be talking with Sharon Dorsey and some other folks who were involved in the protest at the School of the Americas this a few months ago. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. These programs are sponsored in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. At the Y this week, for the Know Your University series, which is sponsored in part by the Office of the Chancellor, we'll be learning about the new ideas for the Krannert Art Museum from the director, Kathleen Harleman. That's Tuesday at noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, where our guest today, Clayton Doffenbaugh, will also be speaking this Thursday afternoon at 4 about some of these issues relating to the Sierra Club. There will not be a Friday forum this week at the Y because of spring break getting started. Coming up here on WILL later this week is a program listeners to Keeping the Faith might find especially interesting, Islam in America. Will be the topic of David Inge on Focus 580 on Wednesday at 10 o'clock. He'll be talking with the religious director of the Islamic Society of Orange County, California, Muzamil Siddiqui. That's Islam in America Wednesday on Focus 580 here on AM 580. on March 17 at 7 p.m., some of the peace churches in the Champaign-Urbana area, the Friends, the Mennonites, and others, are gathering at Community United Church of Christ on the corner of 6th and Daniel for a prayer service in response to the continuing war in Iraq. That's Thursday, March 17 at 7 p.m. at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign, and the public is invited to participate in that. On April 8th, the University Y is having its annual auction, charity auction. For listeners who maybe have never gone to such a thing, let me tell you a little bit about what it's like. You'll get a great dinner. It's at Kennedy's Restaurant in Urbana. Kennedy's at Stone Creek. And that Friday at 6 on April 8th, there'll be all kinds of things you can look at and write down a bid for, and often get some great bargains. There'll also be a live auction, which will include a week at a Minnesota cabin that's quite lovely. That will be, there are actually 2 weeks available. A weekend in Arthur, Illinois, in Amish country at a lovely home there. A shish kebab dinner at a very interesting residential construction site south of Urbana. Homemade pies, blocks of 100 videos donated by That's for Entertainment, dinner at the Beef House for two, lots of art objects, lots of gift certificates from groups in Champaign-Urbana who want to be supportive of the University Y and its work on campus. So if you'd like tickets for that, please call the Y, 337-1500. A wonderful dinner and a chance for some great bargains. That'll be Friday, April 8th, University YMCA auction. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh here on Keeping the Faith. Let me give the phone numbers again for those who might like to call in with a question or comment. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Clayton, when you talk about the concerns of the Sierra Club for conservation, I'm reminded that the late Paul Simon, Senator Paul Simon's last book before his death was on the need to conserve water and the problems not only around the world but here in the Midwest. Is that a concern in the Sierra Club?
Yes, the Sierra Club is certainly concerned about clean water and the protection of wetlands. And here in the Midwest, it's not my area of expertise, but we have a major program to protect the Great Lakes as well, to protect it from pollution and also from being used, sent off to other parts of the world and so forth.
When you talk about the work of the Sierra Club, you mentioned there are local clubs. What happens at a local gathering?
Well, the local groups would be concerned with issues in their local area. So whatever the members of the Sierra Club in that area have determined to be the priorities, that would be the things that a local group would be working on.
Now, you mentioned the Sierra Club has 750,000 members across this country. They pay dues?
Yes, there's a membership fees that that people pay of a variety of levels.
How much does it cost to be a member of the Sierra Club, and how could someone become a member if they wished?
You could probably call either the San Francisco or the Washington offices to get membership information. I have the Washington phone number in front of me. That's 202-547-1141. You can go online at sierraclub.org and join that way.
How is Sierra spelled?
S-I-E-R-R-A-C-L-U-B.
SierraClub.org. We'll get information. All right.
Yes, and you also can find all sorts of information there on the variety of programs that the Sierra Club is involved in, from conservation issues to its outings as well on the website. So the fee itself, I believe, annual membership is $30 or $35. Mm-hmm. Per individual, but I think there are also student and low-income rates and, of course, opportunities for people to give more than that if they choose to.
And when you when you described your job, what is it? What's in your portfolio?
Well, I travel around the Midwest and also somewhat in the Southwest part of the country, offering these presentations about public lands at risk, providing information about what the threats are, and in particular with the churches, as I said, talking about the scriptural, spiritual foundations for care creation, and enlist people, those who are willing, and volunteer efforts to help conserve the public lands.
When you talk about them being at risk, is it mainly government regulations that are the biggest problem, or is it sort of predatory corporations?
Well, it's the cooperation between those two that I think is the primary threat to the public lands, certainly because these are the public lands, that they are managed by the government on our behalf. Government decision-making at administrative and also at legislative levels is critical. But as all aspects of government are, they're influenced by many folks, and those people, those special interests who are organized to make profit from exploitation of public lands, they are particularly influential because they're very well organized. Sierra Club is primarily a volunteer organization. An oil company is not, and it has a very focused agenda, which is to make money, and to make money from the development of oil. So they have, you know, huge resources, both in the time and personnel and in money that are not available to average citizens. So it makes the job of people like the Sierra Club much more difficult.
You mentioned that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has been in the news a great deal lately because that is one of the targets for oil drilling and gas drilling and so on. What other areas are particularly at risk?
Oh, there's, let's see, let's think of some places. There's Otero Mesa in New Mexico. That's in the Chihuahua Desert in the southern part of the state. And Otero Mesa is a place of about 1 million acres, about half of which have been found to have wilderness character. And there is a proposal being advanced against the vociferous opposition of people in the state of New Mexico and the government of the state of New Mexico to drill the wild portions of Otero Mesa for oil. The government's been very determined to open that up. There's a place in Colorado called the Roan Plateau, which is along I-70 near the town of Rifle, for those folks who've been through there. And that's another place that is a primary target for oil and gas development. The Book Cliffs region in the state of Utah is being targeted for oil and gas development. The Sequoia Forest in California, despite the fact that there is a national monument designated to help conserve them, the government seems to be targeting them for increased logging. Oh my gosh, we've already talked about the grasslands in Wyoming and Montana. There's new plans for grasslands in the Dakotas that are being targeted. Those are the ones that all come to mind currently.
333-9455 is the local Champaign-Urbana number if you'd like to ask a question to our guest from the Sierra Club today. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. I might just mention that Keeping the Faith programs are archived and are available for people with access to computers and the Internet to listen to this program or other programs live on WILL, but you can also find previous programs. Just go to 3w.will.uiuc.edu and click on AM 580, and you'll see Keeping the Faith programs from the past several years that you can listen to again if you like, or hear one perhaps you missed. So if you have friends who've missed this program and who'd like it, you may go to will.uiuc.edu and click on this program interviewing Clayton Doffenbaugh from the Sierra Club. Clayton, when you're coming here to talk and give different in-person programs, you'll also be providing some visuals.
Yes.
Tell us about those.
We're going to have pictures of some of these special places, the Arctic Refuge, places in Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, some forest areas and some desert areas and the coastal plain of the Arctic. We'll also have some photographs of what oil and gas developments are actually like on the ground so that people can see the process. It's actually a very lengthy one, beginning with exploration of the area to the actual drilling and construction of the well sites, containment ponds that in many cases are necessary for fluids and water that that are brought up in the process. Many roadways are involved. It cast oil energy developments, cast the net of development across the entire landscape in which they're focused, and permanently alter the natural settings in which they're located. I myself grew up in South Louisiana, and I'm acquainted with swimming in lakes where when you go in, you come out with little drops of oil on you from the oil developments down there in South Louisiana. Those types of things will be shown in the slideshow presentation, as well as information given about further information about the threats to democracy and the governing and management of the public lands as well.
Let me push a little bit on this point, Clayton. You mentioned that wind power is an alternative energy source that doesn't seem to pollute much, but a lot of the wells I see in southern Illinois don't seem to be hurting the farmland around them. Is that unusual?
Well, farmland is also already developed land. It has roads and so forth that are there. So much of the development that would damage the natural habitat has already taken place with farmlands. Also, when you're at a wellhead, on a farm, that area is particularly screened off from the agricultural part of the area. You wouldn't want to grow a crop directly out of an area that's got oil all over it. So those locations are segregated from the rest of the use of that land. But for the purposes of wildlife, the land has already been removed from that because of its agricultural use as a whole. Certainly, open space and agriculture, the hedgerows and what have you, do provide some habitat for wildlife. But the overall natural character of that land has already been altered.
What does the Sierra Club do in terms of trying to get people to conserve energy in this country?
Sierra Club, Sierra Club programs provide education on renewable alternative sources of energy. We also lobby Congress on energy policies, particularly a big priority of the Sierra Club is increasing the amount of miles per gallon that cars are required to attain, because that's probably the single biggest means, the one thing we can do with the biggest impact that would help to conserve on energy. If you read Sierra Magazine, you'll see all sorts of suggestions from time to time about what people can do in their own homes to reduce their use of energy. Those are the types of things. Solar energy is encouraged. As I said, wind energy is an excellent renewable resource as well.
You mentioned that the Sierra Club is the oldest and largest of these organizations of this type in this country. But who are some of the other groups who you see as joining hands with you on some of these issues?
Oh, my gosh. There's a whole wide range of environmental organizations across the country. At the national level, the Wilderness Society, specializes in the preservation of wilderness. You have the National Resources Council that Robert Kennedy III is very involved in, and they focus on scientific aspects of environmental protection. There's the Nature Conservancy, which actually buys up land in order to conserve it. There are land trusts scattered all across the country that enable individual citizens to provide certain conservation measures for their own privately held lands. There's a wide range of other environmental groups out there. There is a growing movement within the religious community for conservation of lands. Global warming is a particular concern of the National Council of Churches. So there's a plethora of different organizations in addition to the Sierra Club that that are out there. And I think it's an example of how much support there is in the American public for protecting the environment and for conservation. The majority of Americans, I think it's quite clear, consider themselves to be friends of the environment and would like our government's policies to reflect that, which unfortunately is not always the case. And again, our Arctic Refuge is Exhibit A in the coming week here.
Now, when you're coming to Champaign-Urbana to speak this next week, you're speaking at least two churches and one interfaith organization, the University of Y.
Yes.
How do Methodist churches, for example, since you are yourself a Methodist, how has the Methodist Church responded to this kind of a crisis in the loss of public lands?
Well, the Methodist Church has a long tradition of being socially involved, going all the way back to John Wesley. It maintains offices on Capitol Hill in Washington, where it can sometimes try to influence the policies both of the executive and legislative branches. But also it has passed a number of resolutions encouraging local churches to promote the spiritual values of the environment. It provides worship resources. It provides educational materials on conservation that people can do in their own homes. Environmental justice is a priority of the Methodist Church. Many of the communities that are most at risk from the health impacts of poor environmental practices tend to be very low income. And so the Methodist Church has provided resources for organizing in some of those areas, which is also a program that the Sierra Club has. It has a very significant environmental justice organizing program for communities across the country, low-income communities that have borne the brunt of toxic waste dumps and pollution and so forth.
How have Jewish religious groups responded to environmental issues?
I'm not 100% sure exactly what the Jewish religious organizations have done, except that they've participated in many of these programs that the National Council of Churches have offered up as well. So as an ecumenical force in the Judeo-Christian tradition, certainly there is a Jewish presence there.
When you talk about the care of creation, seeing the natural world as a creation of God for which religious people have a responsibility to maintain and care for, how could you give us some of the examples from the biblical material that are important to you?
Certainly. The Apostle Paul talks about how, I think this is a direct quote, the invisible existence of God and his everlasting power can be clearly seen by the mind's understanding of created things. This is an idea of creation as a revelation of God's character. You know, God created this and said that it was good. And if we study creation, some of the things I talked about earlier, I think give us guidance as to how to live our own lives, the mutual dependence and support that you find from all the entities of creation, I think is a sign of, loving one's neighbor as yourself, taking care of the community in which we live. The idea of the earth as a neighbor, that we are actually, the ground that we live on, the air that we breathe, the food that we eat, that we're part of this larger community of creation, I think is important. If you look at the book of Revelation, you can see several passages where it's made quite clear that the new Jerusalem, the salvation of human beings, is only part of the larger salvation message of that book. It's the entire creation that the author of the book of Revelation was seeking to find redemption for. The Apostle Paul talks about that as well. When Jesus uses examples of how God cares for us, look at the birds in the sky. They don't have to sow or reap or gather, yet God takes care of them. Underlying that message is a belief that God cares for creation and that we should as well. The mustard seed parable is a wonderful example of Jesus's view of what the kingdom of God is as it pertains or as you can perceive it from how nature works.
We have another caller waiting on one of our local lines, line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Initially, I want to say that I applaud your work and your organization's work. I think it's
thank you.
Secondly, this might not be a fair question, but can you give me any insights into like the mindset of the Christian right? That I mean, what they base their viewpoint that the earth is there to, to be subject to man's exploitation, so to speak?
Well, I think there are, of course, the Christian right is a pretty broad group, but I think there's two places that you hear about most frequently. One is the quotation from the book of Genesis that was mentioned earlier about humans being given dominion over the planet. And so I think there's a misconception of dominion as being license to exploit whatever are the ends of human beings, as opposed to a dominion from the perspective of needing to care for something. And so it's a misconception of dominion that I think is out there. And then there's also a perception among some folks that the earth is going to be coming to an end when Jesus returns, and so it's really of not really all that much importance in the grander scheme of things. And I think that also is a misinterpretation of the scripture. I think the scripture is very clear that, as I was just saying, that the redemption of creation is part of the greater salvation that that the church is to help bring to the world, and that will ultimately come from God for all the world. That it's not just human souls that are going to be saved, but it's the trees and it's the ground and it's the air that's intended to be saved as well.
A previous guest a couple weeks ago on Keeping the Faith was Professor Barbara Rossings, who was talking about her study of the apocalypse and the end times and the book of Revelation. And she had some wonderful insights distinguishing what she feels is an appropriate interpretation, accurate interpretation of the book of Revelation in terms of some of the things you've been saying, as opposed to the far right, right-wing Christians who have a very different view. So if listeners would like to listen to that, it's available on the archives here at WILL.UIUC.edu under Keeping the Faith, Barbara Rossing, and she was on February 27. Getting back to Clayton Doffenbaugh, our guest today, We're down to just the last couple of minutes, Clayton. Any last concerns about public lands at risk for our listeners?
I think people should look for their own special place, the one that is close to their heart, that they have enjoyed, and find ways in which they can be active to make sure that that place is preserved. And so I would encourage people to do that and to know that our relationship with the world around us is not just a physical one, but also a spiritual one. And if we as humans are to be whole, the world that we live in needs to be whole as well.
And for listeners who would like to see the presentations you're bringing to Champaign-Urbana, several different locations, tell us again where those will be and when.
Tuesday, 7:30 at Wesley United Methodist Church, 1203 West Green Street.
Green and Goodwin in Urbana.
Yes. Wednesday, the 16th, 7:30 at 112 West Main in Urbana. Thursday, noon at the Kiwanis Club at Chancellor Hotel. Thursday, 4 o'clock, University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street. And Thursday evening, 7 o'clock at First United Methodist in Champaign at 210 West Church.
And these are all free and open to the public, and you'll Absolutely. Be having visuals that people can see of some of these lovely places around our country that are at risk because of changes in the way the government is managing these public lands and changing regulations. Well, thank you very much to our guest, Clayton Doffenbaugh from the Sierra Club.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Information on the Sierra Club is available online at sierraclub.org, or you may call the Washington National Office 202-547-1141. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here on WILL on Sunday afternoon. Next week, our guest will be a part of the Whirlwind Project series. We'll be interviewing a professor from the University of Illinois, a scientist, Professor Bruce Folk. We'll be talking with him about evolution and religion. That's next Sunday here on Keeping the Faith. The following Sunday, which is Easter Sunday for the Christian religion, Richard Young and Martin Marty will be our guests, talking about Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ, which Haydn wrote to be performed on Good Friday. And we'll be talking about that music and the meaning of some of those seven last words. On April 3rd, our guest here on Keeping the Faith will be Sharon Dorsey and other folks who were protesting at the School of the Americas. That's April 3rd here on Keeping the Faith. Coming up this week at the Y, Kathleen Harleman will be Tuesday noon at Know Your University, a free luncheon lecture. That's at 1001 South Wright in Champaign. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Mark Sundin got an offer he couldn't refuse. A publisher paid him up front to write a book on bullfighting in Spain. Mark doesn't speak Spanish, knows nothing about bullfighting, and hates to travel, but that didn't stop him from writing the book. He just made the whole thing up. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, The Art of Faking It. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 Central Time here on WILL Urbana.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASC-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low around 18 degrees and northeast winds up to 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the mid-40s and northwest winds up to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 20s and east winds up to 5 miles per hour. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high in the lower 40s and north winds up to 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.